did Khalifa and Nima, and I don't know anything about these things, but I'm happy to pretend for us all and share the thimbleful that I've gathered. And you can, as you did yesterday, you know, tell me what you, where you think I'm going astray. And then tomorrow we'll sort of go look at things from maybe the developments of the late 19th century down to the present, you know, focusing on His Holiness and sort of situation. So we're trying to come back around to Gelugpa again. Not that we don't keep making reference to it all along as we get. Now, one of the things I talked about yesterday at the beginning was that there seems to be a lot more diversity in terms of what people say about the Madhyamaka view. This is my impression outside of Gelugpa than you find inside Gelugpa. And why is that? Well, I think there's a bunch of reasons, and I'm not really, you know, sure exactly how to pin it down. But one is that, like in the case of Gagyapa, for example, and Nyingma, also you don't have a single central, strong, organized institutional structure. You have institutionalized structures in Gagyapa, but they're not all controlling. And you have this, and in Gelugpa, traditionally at least, there's been a central institutional structure associated with an educational system. And even though it has subdivisions, they're bound together closely in a family. I was always thinking, it's like, well, you know, some religious institutions just like find part of their identity in a sense of oneness with the other people who are of that brand, even if they're far away, where others really don't. And that makes a big difference, I think, in this case. Okay, so that's one possibility. Another thing is that there's less emphasis on discursive presentations of the view outside of Gelugpa. I mean, as we go from Gelugpa to Sakya, come up against the fact that, well, their view of emptiness is that it's beyond all conceptualization. And then you start to wonder, well, how much can we say about it then? You know, and so, and then, of course, when you go into Gagyapa and Nyingma, it's even more so. And you get, although people do write about these things, they write about them less often and perhaps with less a sense of commitment that this is what's really important than what you find in Gagyapa, because there's other sort of practice-based ways that people are entering into reality, shall we say, in those systems, which aren't so much foregrounding the role of studying, learning a philosophy, and then internalizing that discursive philosophy systematically in order to prepare for it to become non-discursive. They have other ways of approaching things. Another thing is, I think, because you have in Gagyapa, for example, you have all these different lineages are so important, and rather than sort of a central idea from somebody like Tsongkhapa, that you have different teachers teaching according to what they think their students need to hear, and then I really do find myself reading all these different things and trying to sort them out and wondering whether what I'm reading is really the person who's writing's final view or not. You know what I'm saying? It's like, I think they're saying what they think, they really are saying sometimes what they think is the most useful to the people they're talking to, and not necessarily, okay, now I'll outline the final view. So anyway, it's very difficult. Then in this case, we got interested yesterday in this issue of self-empty and other-empty. And, you know, the question is, so we know the Jonangas are self-defining as other emptiness, and Geluk is self-emptiness. There are Geluks who are, you know, arguing for other emptiness. And the Jonangas only apply self-emptiness to conventional phenomena and not to the ultimate. So it's very, very nice and tidy. We should come to Kagyupa's a lot, and Nyingma too, but especially in Kagyupa. It's like, it's very much more complicated. Like, what exactly does Shendong mean? And I don't fully understand all of this, but I'll just tell you what I've figured out so far. Okay, so that's just sort of stage setting. So we have to say something about the origins of the Kagyupa tradition a little bit, like we did yesterday. So this is one of the, you know, Sarma traditions, when it, along with Sakya, in the established in Tibet during the second diffusion of the Dharma. And the tradition is that there was a Siddha in India, Tilopa, who lived from 988 to 1069, who was a had been a Brahmin and a monk, and then became a monk, and then had a Dakini appear to him, who told him that he needed to renounce all conventional forms of behavior if he was going to know the true nature of reality, and he took her up on it, engaged in unconventional behavior, talked like a madman, wandered in the street, didn't, you know, observe his the proper conduct for a monk, and so forth, and eventually lived as a hermit and meditated intensively, and then eventually he found his teacher, Vajradhara, he did not a human teacher, but it's understood that Vajradhara is appearing as a, what do you say, a pure enjoyment, bliss body, so, of Buddha. So normally a bliss body would only teach, like, you know, highly advanced beings, not like ordinary beings. And so then Tilopa took the teachings that is the beginning of that's where the Kagyupa tradition traces itself back to in India, is that point. And then Naropa comes. Naropa was a great scholar and abbot at Nalanda. He lived from 1016 to 1100. And he knew everything about the Dharma from a scholastic point of view. And according to the story, one day an old woman, I guess an old, ugly woman, it's the classic hag, meets him, and she says, "Well, do you really understand all this stuff, or you just know how to talk about it?" And he said, "Both." And she looked him in the eye, and she knew he didn't really know, and he knew that she knew he didn't really know. And so then he said, "Well," she said, "Well, if you want to really understand, then you have to go find my brother." And then she disappeared. And so it's like, then the abbot went to the assembly at Nalanda and said, "Well, I met this woman, and she said that if I want to really understand the Dharma, I have to go find her brother, and so I'm going." Isn't that a great story? So he wandered around a long time and eventually found Tilopa. So that was the beginning, the first human-to-human connection as his teacher. And then, of course, sometimes you get stories that the old woman was a Dakini, and sometimes you get stories that she was Tilopa appearing, you know, his guru. And, of course, then are they really different and so forth. So then the transmission of this line to Tibet comes with Marpa. So Marpa is in that 11th century, lives from 1012 to 1097. And so he's part of the big project of transmitting the Dharma from India to Tibet. In the second diffusion, he's a translator, and he made repeated visits from Tibet down to India as part of that work. He was a layman throughout his life, as to my understanding. And and that's where he met Naropa and received the transmission of the teachings that Vajradhara had given to Tilopa, had given to Naropa, were given passed to Marpa, and Marpa took them back to Tibet. And then, of course, Marpa gives them to Milarepa, and I think everybody knows that story, so I'm not going to go through that. But, you know, it's like Milarepa has all these tales, terrible karma, because he's been doing harming people and actually killing people with his yogic powers. And And then Marpa has to put him through a lot of purification activities in order to make him a suitable vessel. But eventually he receives the transmission. And all of the transmissions, all of the teachings, and all of the secret and final teachings are passed on, including, of course, famously, the very last teaching that Marpa gives to Milarepa was to pull up his robes and show him his butt, which is covered with calluses. So... Or to Gompapa. Gompapa. Yeah, oh, that's what I thought. Yeah, you're right. I had it Marpa going the other. Okay, so then Milarepa is the great cotton-clad yogi, and then he transmits the Dharma to... He's a hermit, right? But then he transmits the Dharma to Gompapa. And he's then the author of the... basically the important thing is that Gompapa is, unlike Milarepa, not like a yogi living in a cave. He goes, you know, out and gathers disciples. And so all the lineages, the diverse lineages of Kagyupa, trace themselves back to Gompapa, disciple of Milarepa, disciple of Marpa. And also, the various disciples of Gompapa are the sources for all these different lineages. So that's where it begins. There's lots of people that suddenly start branching off at that point. And you have, according to the tradition, you have four major lineages and eight minor lineages that break off. But then many of them seem to have died out or been absorbed into other ones and don't really exist independently anymore. And then in addition, it seems that actually in the world today, there are some that do exist that aren't on the list of the original 12, which is, so in other words, this is a complicated issue of all these different lineages. And actually, you can look up on the website, you can see, that there are different kinds of Kagyupa. There's some Kagyupas who say, that they were originally Kagyupas, but they don't even want the name Kagyupa. They're just going to take their subdivision name and say, we're this. Because we don't want to, have other Kagyupas thinking that we should have to do things the way they do, and so forth like that. So it gets a little bit... there's a lot of diversity, like I was saying at the beginning, in the way people are approaching things. Okay, so then let's look at a few of the names that are on the list of Tibetan names relevant to Tibetan Madhyamaka. Look at a few of these other people. We'll skip Pakmo Drupa. And the Rangjung Dorje. So one of the main line that we're going to talk about, because it's impossible for me to even understand this, let alone all the other ones, is the Karma Kagyu. So the Karma Kagyu have their basis at the Tsurpu Monastery, and the Karmapas are the reincarnating heads of this lineage, and in between the time they're reincarnating, they have regents, and sometimes these regents are part of other reincarnating lineages who stand in for them while the next one is being found and raised. So Rangjung Dorje lived from the 13th to the 14th century, was the third Karmapa. And he turns as kind of an important figure in the history of Tibetan Buddhism because he was the first one who spontaneously generated the black hat that was Lord Crown that becomes a sort of symbol of the Karma Kagyu lineage. And he was actually born into a Nyingma family himself before he was recognized. And so he had a full transmission of Nyingma as well as becoming then the head of Gagyupa. And I don't know if you noticed it, but there is this kind of even though Nyingma is old and Kagyu is new, there's a lot of institutions where they just cooperate and have the same school, basically, which, sort of Dzogchen, Mahamudra, he's sort of suggesting, maybe they're recognizing a little family resemblance between their basic approach and practices there, even though one's coming from the new diffusion and one's coming from the original diffusion. But another thing that's interesting that I wanted to just mention Rangjung Dorje briefly was that besides being a kind of Nyingma, fully transmitted Nyingma, who was also the head of Karma Kagyu, he also basically, I don't know exactly how to put this, I'm not sure what the right way to put it is, but I mean, he is the one who invited Dolpapa to come, and he lived during the time of Dolpapa. He asked Dolpapa to come and stay, you know, at his monastery and give teachings. And it seems that, like, that is the point at which, obviously, a strong, not just Shendong in some general sense, but specifically Jonang influence comes into the Karma Kagyupa line, right there at the beginning, between the third Karmapa and Dolpapa. And so it really seems that Rangjung Dorje was influenced by at least some of Dolpapa's theories. And then it seems that, like, maybe not all the later Karmapas were completely comfortable with that. But, of course, they can't really directly refute Rangjung Dorje direct. So they have all these different ways of interpreting or explaining or contextualizing or framing what Shendong means. Because they've got Shendong now, in the sense, because Rangjung Dorje has, like, at the third Karmapa point, has, like, brought it into the lineage. So I've read, and I haven't actually read the text or anything like that, but that the seventh Karmapa was engaged in doing a project of interpreting Shendong as it had been accepted by the third Karmapa. So this, the implication I take from that is that it was the beginning of a process of backing off from a whole-scale commitment to Shendong in a Jonang sense, which doesn't mean that the word Shendong is being erased, but it's being interpreted, right, in a new way, so that we're not, it's not like there's been going to be a merger of Jonang and Kagyupa. Then along those same lines, after the eighth Karmapa, Mikyur Dorje, lived in the 16th century, and we're going to come back, we're going to actually look at, talk a little bit about some of his stuff later on, but it seems that his view is either that Shendong is not Madhyamaka, but is a sort of some form of Yogacara or, you know, high-level Chittamatra type view, or else if it's said that it is Madhyamaka, that has to be, its statements have to be subject to some further interpretation in order to be correct. So, you know, sort of like not really comfortable with the idea of saying there is a Shendong Madhyamaka and that is the final view that I, Mikyur Dorje, is. So it's part of that same project that his predecessor had started. But not everything is going in that direction. And it seems like the word Shendong, what for now and whatever it means, is like not going to be erased, even if it's going to be reinterpreted. In the 19th century, you had this major figure called Zhangong Kongtrul. There's actually, he's a reincarnating lama, so there's a lot of Zhangong Kongtruls, but the original one is this Zhangong Kongtrul Lodur Taye, who lived for most of the 19th century. And he was, you know, in eastern Tibet, and he was one of the co-founders of what's called the Rime movement. Have you guys heard of that? It's like the non-sectarian movement, so-called in English, I guess, non-sectarian movement in eastern Tibet in the 19th century. And so there's this, I don't know, we'll talk maybe about Rime a little bit more, but it seems that, like, one of the ways, actually I've read some of Zhangong Kongtrul's stuff, and to me, it's very strongly Shendong. And it seems to have the idea that you can use Shendong as the basis for some kind of, well, the basis for being non-sectarian. You can, and then you're sort of thinking, well, doesn't that leave someone out? So that has a kind of a political meaning. But when you read these texts, they do, Rime texts, they do include, and, you know, they take account of Gelugpa views, and I'm sure they're very much influenced by Gelugpa views. But the basis for the kind of, what do you say, comparative theology that they're doing seems to come from this Shendong point of view. And then I don't know what to say about, you know, contemporary people. I'm sure you guys know more about it than I do. I just picked this one, Kenpo Tsultun Gyantso Rinpoche. Seems to be the teacher of a lot of other teachers who are important. And my understanding is that this guy, of course, was a great yogi, contemporary of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, great yogi in Tibet, practiced chur and a lot of hermit stuff, and also studied a great deal. That it seems that at least some of the people who have come down from him are very strongly Shendong, even in like Jonangbas, essentially, like this Lama Shenpen Hukum, Susan Hukum, is like the Buddha Within book. So she wrote the first book that, you know, we had to read on other emptiness, and no one could figure out what it was saying. It was like very hard to understand what the point was. Was that because of the way the book was done, or is it because we just weren't used to these ideas? Anyway, it's like now there's like so many books, but you know, she is in this comes out of this comes from Kenpo Tsultin Gyantso's line. Okay, so anyway, that's like just a little bit about some of the people. Now let's see. Oh yeah, I have to do next. Now before we come back and explore Shendong, I wanted to do a little bit of actual quick glimpse at some of the ideas from Karmakagyu commentary on Chandrakirti. This is some. I'm just going to pick some synoptic points from the ninth Karmapa, Wangjuk Dorje. So he's the successor to Mikir Dorje. His commentary on Chandrakirti's supplement for the Middle Way. And I'm just going to pick out some points that are either interesting to what we're going to talk about or relevant to some things we've already talked about. First of all, and first interesting point is relevant to our discussion about studying other people's points of view. He quotes a sutra, "Those who study a teaching and become attached to it will become angry when they hear something that is not their teaching. Their pride and conceit will defeat them and lead them only to suffering." So it sort of starts out, with this like, okay, don't take any of this too seriously kind of framework. And then at the end of the book, he comes back around to that too. But of course, in the middle, he like says, what's wrong with Tsongkhapa? What's wrong with Sherab Gyaltsen? You know, what's wrong with Shakya Chokdem? What's wrong with Kolrampa? And all these people's faults in understanding Chandrakirti are clearly explained. But we have to understand how he's doing this from him, what this means to him from his own point of view, which I'll say in a second. In following the middle way, what is one doing? One dismantles the views of others while at the same time not positing a position of one's own. That's what one's doing. So when he's like criticizing Tsongkhapa, criticizing Dolpapa or so forth, he's doing this for the sake of freeing them and their followers from attachment to those views, and not because he on his own behalf advocates some thesis which is the opposite of that. Because to do that from an ultimate point of view would be contrary to the reality of things. He says this like over and over again. If you see what I'm saying, it's like, okay, this isn't the way, you know, this isn't a Gelugpa way of doing things, but you have to say, okay, this is their way of doing things. It's like this is how he understands what it means to be a prasangika. By doing this, he's establishing himself as a prasangika, as he understands what Nagarjuna and Chandrakirti were saying. Absolutely. So, for example, the genuine followers of the middle way, from their own side, and in terms of their own take on things, have no position or thesis whatsoever. Therefore, any appearance of their adopting a thesis, as you will see that he does have such appearances, is an instance of their using their language to help others to skillfully communicate. They temporarily will adopt a certain perspective in order to lead others to the result of seeing genuine reality, which is something beyond any thesis or position. So for an example of a position that he takes to help us, we were discussing the question of like how the Four Noble Truths relate to the Two Truths the other day, and like how there's actually, this is one issue in which there is a difference within Gelugpa between Losaling, which says that the true cessations are conventional truths, and the other textbook authors who say that it's an ultimate truth. And so, you know, that's... So that's kind of interesting, and then you have to figure out what to say about that. So he raises this question. He says, from a conventional perspective, the truths of suffering, origin, path are relative, while the truth of sensation is ultimate because it is unconditioned. But that's just from a relative point of view. In the final analysis, all four truths are relative truths. Why? Because they depend on each other to be designated as truths. And that, so he uses the same kind of argument that I was hearing Venerable Dupten Chögrön use in terms of like positing how things are only established relatively in relationship to one another. And he's saying, well, these truths aren't findable as having any independent truth of their own. So when we analyze them, they're not sustained. They don't show up under a prasangika analysis. So we're not going to posit any of them as ultimate truths. That's the way he understands it, what ultimate truth would be. So for he does the same thing, for example, with the arising from how things arise. So there's no arising from any of the four extremes. And then later in the first verse of the first chapter of Nagarjuna, and then later in the 11th verse of the 22nd chapter of Nagarjuna, says, we don't assert emptiness, we don't assert non-emptiness, we don't assert both, we don't assert neither, we only use labels. And so, of course, this is exactly what Wangjuk Dorje, the ninth Karmapa, he feels that he can take this very literally, where of course Tsongkhapa has to like put in some adverbs, or like from the point of view of, you know, like you would with the Heart Sutra and Nagarjuna, in order to say, well, okay, what does this mean? Because of course our position is that emptiness is the absence of here in existence, and of course that's only in a conventional expression, but conventionally that is the position that we will hold. And then, but then Nagarjuna in that verse doesn't lay it out exactly in those terms. He puts it more in the like, well, we don't have any assertion or position. So he takes that and he says, let's look back at the first verse where Tsongkhapa says, well, things are not arisen in any way from, you know, self, other, both, or neither.
Nagarjuna.
Yeah, Nagarjuna's first verse, right? They say, well, when he says that, he's not like advocating the thesis that things don't arise. He's just saying that your claim that they arise from self, that's in the case of Sankhya. He's gonna say, well, for the sake of helping you, I will prove you why that's contradictory, but it doesn't mean I'm gonna advocate the opposite of that. You see what I'm saying? Tsongkhapa thinks this is nonsense, by the way. You know, you can read this is very interesting. Tsongkhapa doesn't name names, but he doesn't mince words. And he talks about this kind of thing, and it's exactly what he thinks. He said, like, well, we're talking conventionally and speaking conventionally. When you refute something, you can't really very well turn around and say that, you know, you're not holding that's not the case, because that's what she just said. Yeah. But that's exactly what he thinks is the opposite of being a prasangika. Prasangika is more like a potsap. You know, remember we did potsap on the first day. Potsap thinks, look, to really be a follower of Chandrakirti, this is a commentary on Chandrakirti, you have to be an utter skeptic. Doesn't mean you don't say things. You know, you might think, you know, it'd be, you can look at the practices. It looks like you make an argument. It's like, is it possible to help people improve their situation without holding, from your own point of view, any fixed thesis? You know, and you know, Potsap thinks it is, and so does Wangjuk Dorje. They're trying to help people by pointing out that, you know, the ultimate is beyond any conceptualization, beyond any elaboration. But people are just grabbing onto one concept or another after it, and it's not going to help them just to replace, you know, one gross conceptualization with another. What we have to do is whatever one they're grasping onto, point out the problems with it until they become free of any of those kinds of conceptual ideas. So that's the way they're looking at it. Okay, so when he comes to this whole thing about, so he does a long treatment of Tsongkhapa's criticism of Tsongkhapa's treatment of Chandrakirti's criticism of Bhava Viveka for criticizing Buddha Palatha. In other words, is there really a, you guys got that? In other words, well, you know, the whole thing, is there really a difference in the view between Svatantrika and Prasangika? But Tsongkhapa says that Chandrakirti is point, you know, his criticism of how Bhava Viveka argues, let's just say, is a, you know, discovering, unmasking, you know, a hidden ontological commitment in Bhava Viveka. And this is a really interesting thing, because as I read it, like as you go through all the points of the argument, which he's clearly read and carefully in Tsongkhapa, he seems to understand it and to not exactly disagree with it. But what he won't do is come to the conclusion, which is therefore Bhava Viveka doesn't have the final correct view.
He doesn't conclude that.
No. It's like almost like how can you kind of go along with and find reason in all of Tsongkhapa's arguments, but then not be willing to accept the conclusion? And well, okay, so I don't know. I have my understanding of this is that it sort of fits with what I was saying earlier. He thinks that Bhava Viveka is skillfully trying to help people, and that for some people, skillfully trying to help them toward the Madhyamaka view will involve making formal syllogisms. And for other people, it might involve stating consequences. Now, if you know you can develop an argument that the former method with the former syllogisms might have, as Tsongkhapa did, imply some sort of ontological commitment, it doesn't mean that commitment's really in the mind of the teacher who's chosen to use that method. That's my interpretation. Another thing is, like, well, it's really clear that this is a long-standing criticism of Tsongkhapa by lots of people. We see in Koramba yesterday, of that they just really are not going to allow Gyanagarbha, Shantarakshita, Kamala Shila, all of the Madhyamakas who have the Yogacara influence. It's not so much that they all wound up about Bhava Viveka, but these other people, all the Yogacara influenced Madhyamakas from India, they're all in this kind of like Bhava Viveka lineage as well. And they don't want those people to be considered lesser Madhyamakas. Why? Because if Gyanagarbha and Kamala Shila and Shantarakshita, those Yogacara Svatantrika parentheses Madhyamakas, if they didn't articulate the correct view, then one can't realize the ultimate reality by relying upon what they taught. And they want to use those things. They think that there's a lot of wisdom in those Madhyamakas. They consider it sort of a slander against the so-called Svatantrikas. In fact, they call them Svatantrikas, but they just don't accept that they have any wrong view. It's another way of talking about the right view, a way that they often like. Then he addresses the question of what's the relationship between the two truths. He is Wangjuk Dorje, the ninth Karmapa. That's everything I'm saying is sort of here trying to be based off of that. And so what does Tsongkhapa say that the relationship between the two truths is? He says that they're one entity, but different conceptual isolates. But then that's not so important, is the fact that they're also mutually contradictory or exclusive phenomena that exist together in a single entity. So if you think about it that way. So it's like mutually that's right. Because no conventional truth is an ultimate truth. No ultimate truth is it. This is Tsongkhapa. No conventional truth is an ultimate truth. No ultimate truth is a conventional truth. Yet everything that we can point at or think of or look at, there's conventional truth and ultimate truth both co-equally there. You can't find any way to chop the conventional. How can you chop the conventional part apart from the ultimate part? Only by the way you look at it. There's no other way, because whatever part of it you look at, conventional truth and ultimate truth are both equally there. But at the same time, you can't say that form literally is emptiness, because then if I saw form with my eye, then I would be directly perceiving emptiness, and then I would be an Arya. Right? So you have to understand, of course, what the Heart Sutra means when it says form is emptiness. It's all,
The Heart Sutra doesn't say form is emptiness. It's empty.
Maybe, yeah. Well, this is there's a lot. This is one of those things where I think there's a lot of what would you say? Okay, form is empty. Empty is form.
Spirit is emptiness.
Emptiness is form. Do you posit that as your own position? Oh, okay. All right, and that's the point. So you have to put adverbs in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras to make Tsongkhapa's view work. It's not that these other people don't have to do interpretation too. It's just that they're doing it on different passages. You saw that with Dolpapa. He's got all these texts that say emptiness or ultimate reality doesn't exist in and of itself, and he has to interpret them because that's exactly the opposite of his position, right? So anyway, what did the Karmapa doesn't agree with Dzongpa's idea of how the two truths exist. Instead, he says, the two truths are neither the same entity nor different entities. And so, why? Because they arise independent of one another. They're dependent arisings that exist in relationship to one another. And so you can't say they're either the same or different. They're not identical, because then they wouldn't be able to depend on each other, and they're not other than each other, or there wouldn't be any dependence. So they have this kind of relationship that's have the same thing that we use to talk about, you know, how production works. He uses that to talk about the relationship between the two truths, and he quotes Nagarjuna. When something originates in dependence upon something else, the depender is not the same as the depended on, nor is it different from it. And in this way, we transcend both extremes. That's 18.10 in Fundamental Wisdom, of the Fundamental Treatise on the Middle Way. So, quoting that, he says, well, the two truths depend on each other in just this way. Why? Because the meaning of conventional truth is falsity. It's the opposite. It's like we think of two kinds of truth, but conventional truth is explained as falsity, that which does not exist as it appears. And ultimate truth is that which does exist as it appears. So they're co-relative terms. They're interdependent in the same way, you know, hot and cold and up or down. So that's his argument. And so because of that, you can't really say that they're the same or different. They're co-relative. What is emptiness, according to the ninth Karmapa? First, he says, all phenomena born through omniscience from the outset are not established whatsoever as any extreme elaboration, such as existent, non-existent, arisen, ceased, permanent, impermanent, empty, not empty, true, or false. So then, to not be established, emptiness means not being established in any extreme form of elaboration. But then, in the next paragraph, he says that just takes this as being the same thing as meaning that emptiness means that conventionally all phenomena are empty of their own entities. Conventionally all phenomena are empty of their own entities. That's the way we talk. We say conventionally, when we want to talk about emptiness, we say it means things are empty of their own entities. But that's not what it really means. Because that, you know, if you held on to that as the meaning of emptiness, you would be taking the extreme of emptiness. You would engage in a proliferation or a conceptual elaboration or contrivance with regard to the sheer nature of reality, which is inexpressible and inconceivable.
That's called the extreme of emptiness?
Yeah, they have like extremes of emptiness and extremes of, like, that's one of the extremes. All phenomena from form through omniscience from the outset are not established whatsoever as any extreme elaboration, and then he lists a bunch of these extreme elaborations, and among them are empty and not empty.
Could you go through the four again? I mean, both the neither, but the examples of the four extremes.
Oh. Examples of the four extremes. Well, usually they do existent, non-existent, and then both and neither. But then sometimes they do, what do they mean?
Yeah,
well, let's see. We're talking about forms through omniscience. So to say, to hold that a form is, to hold the extreme that a form is non-existent, you know, we could think that would be like saying the form doesn't exist at all.
So that would be the extreme of non-existent.
Yeah, instead of holding that a form, the extreme that a form exists in, means you have a reifying grasping onto the form exists truly or by way of its own nature. But see, then when you refute the idea, when you say, okay, let's find the middle way between those two, we're good with that so far, because now we have the conventional idea that things exist as empty. But that's then another one of the extremes that they list.
Okay.
Do you see what I'm saying? He doesn't just stop with things don't exist, they don't not exist, and they aren't both, and they don't either. He goes on, they go on to list any kind of extreme. Basically, there are lists of extremes, but they're not intended to be fixed. A lot of times they put et cetera at the end of them. And then sometimes, like in this case, they add like 8 or 10 different extremes. And so the point is like any kind of dualistic elaboration is a fault, regardless of it. And that's important, because then when you say, oh, I've got it now, things are empty of true existence, well, you've gone to another extreme, according to their... And that's also what Kalaramba says, too. Yeah.
So they would say that just saying the words is an extreme, as well as a conceptual realization of emptiness, is an extreme.
Well, he says right here, I'm not talking about Kalaramba now, but the Wangzhou Dorje, he says, conventionally, we can say that all phenomena are empty of their entities. But if you then... saying that, think that, okay, now I have the Madhyamaka view, that is not the Madhyamaka view. Because the Madhyamaka view is this idea that things are beyond any kind of proliferation, including the extreme of emptiness. Oh, I'll skip over a little detail, but and just mention them so we can get on to other things. He criticized Dolpapa. Dolpapa quotes the Kalachakra. Dolpapa, wants to say, look, this realizing that things are empty when you analyze them is not really the heart of the matter. It's really realizing this sublime ultimate truth, which is the Buddha within. And so he quotes, Dolpapa quotes the Kalachakra Tantra to refute Chandrakirti. But that's the kind of stuff that he does. So the emptiness of analyzing the aggregates, this is Kalachakra Tantra, the emptiness of analyzing the aggregates is like a banana tree without pith. So it's not that he's just, you can interpret that a lot of ways, just saying, well, yeah, when you analyze things, you find that they have no core. No, that's not what Dolpapa thinks it means at all. He's saying this whole process of thinking you're discovering reality by finding that there's no, there's no graspable thing there when you analyze the aggregates, that itself is pithless. And what is the pith we want is the real Buddha within, which you haven't mentioned yet when you're doing this analysis of how the banana, it's like a banana tree. So then, of course, Wangzhou Dorje takes that as a starting point to criticize Dolpapa. And I take it that the purport of this criticism is basically to say, look, when you're doing, similar to Tsongkhapa, that when you're doing Kalachakra or some other tantra, you should be bringing into that the proper Madhyamaka view. Of course, as Wangzhou Dorje understands it, the view of Chandrakirti should be the base of the empty. That emptiness should be the base of the practice, not this truly existent Buddha within that Dolpapa advocates. So this comes back to this question of having some position. This is very much toward the end of his commentary on Chandrakirti. When thoroughly analyzing, it's like this. Suppose we have the statement, in our system, we do not speak of Buddha's wisdom as being existent or non-existent, quote unquote. Well, we do not even say that when thoroughly analyzing. That's something that we say only conventionally. Not understanding that, the proponents of things, realists, criticize us. And now I've come to understand, reading this a few times, that the proponents of things means Tsongkhapa and his followers. Right? Is the proponents of things criticize us, saying, refraining from asserting either existence or non-existence is itself your own system. You've posited throughout this whole commentary that your view is that things are beyond the proliferation of any extremes. Now you can't say, I don't hold the view that, quote, things are beyond any extremes. That's what you've just finished explaining to us. And that the fact that those realists say that, Tsongkhapa and the other realists say that, it just shows that they're not listening to what we're trying to say. When we say we don't hold, you know, from the point of view of ultimate analysis, there's not, no stream we hold on to. That's words that are trying to get you to understand something. And if you just then turn around and say, oh, now you're holding another position, you're just like refusing to hear us. That's what he's saying. You see what I'm saying? Not? Oh, yeah. What we're saying, you know, it's like just saying the words, we don't hold any position. That's not a position. That's what he's saying. That's not a position. That's trying to communicate with you. Yeah, I know. I know. And then sometimes I say, we'll Tsongkhapa does say that. He does say that. And he's already read Tsongkhapa. And he knows that Tsongkhapa says that. And he's just put off by it, like I was by the Baha'i guy, you know, saying, you know what I'm saying? It's like, I've tried to tell you I don't believe in God. And he's like, oh, that's your way of doing it. And I'm like, that's what Tsongkhapa, he's frustrated because he feels like, look, we're trying to tell you that we don't have any from our own side when we analyze, we don't have any position. So that's how they feel. So you have to like what? Give credit to take them seriously on their own terms, whether you think from your own side it's incoherent or not. I guess that's what, that's the message. Okay. All right, so that was a little showing at least that you can like have a whole commentary on Madhyamaka text that expresses a karma kagyu point of view and doesn't mention anything really. It only criticizes other emptiness and even really does that in passing. Doesn't really make too big a deal about it. Then we could go to like a different time and a different point of view. And this is from Andy Carr's, I think I told this story before, Andy Carr's book, Contemplating Reality, which is a very readable book that presents a contemporary kind of guide to different ways of looking at Buddhist philosophy from a Shendong Karma Kagyu contemporary American general reader point of view. It's real good. Like if you just, you know, want to understand how are they thinking about the tenet systems? What do they say about Vaibhashika, Savatranika, Svatantrika? What do they say about Chittamatra? And then you go up the ladder of tenets, and then after Madhyamaka, there comes something else. Shendong Madhyamaka. Chapter 16, after all the discussion about Nagarjuna and Chandrakirti is over. Okay? And the chapter starts this way. At the end of the 1970s, a young Kagyu lineage holder was preparing for his first teaching tour of North America, and he was nervous about how to present the Dharma to these Injis in the West. Such a different world. So he went to his group and said, tell them they are basically good. And then, after a short pause, he added, but if they want to know more, tell them they are Buddhas. Okay. Well, that's his... You read the Uttaratantra Shastra yesterday. So you say, like, then what he does is he goes from there into an extended discussion and quotation and explication of several different verses from the Uttaratantra Shastra to say, look, this is like, you know, this is the teaching that's at stake here. And then he goes on to quote Zhamgong Kongchul Lojer Taye, whom I mentioned as the 19th century, you know, co-founder of Rime from the Karma Kagyu perspective, who was very much associated with Shendong. And is trying to use Shendong as a basis for this kind of synthesis isn't the right word. It's not synthesis. Rime isn't synthesis, but it's like a dialogue of mutual understanding among different traditions, but it's coming from kind of a Shendong perspective. So Zhamgong Kongchul says, it is explained clearly that sutras teach that all phenomena have no inherent nature, nishvabhava, no ni meva. But these statements are explained in sutra that it should not be taken literally, and anyone who does take such statements literally is a propounder of nihilism. Okay, so what is a sutra? He's referring to the Sanina Rinpoche Sutra. And he's like saying, basically he's saying, like we're putting this as a kind of Madhyamaka after Chandrakirti in the ladder of tenets, but it's basically taking the third turning of the wheel as the definitive one and saying that the second turning of the wheel of perfection and wisdom sutras and so forth all have to be interpreted when they say that things are empty of their own nature. Okay? So this explanation of emptiness, according to Andy Carr, avoids the dead end of other kinds of Madhyamaka. Shendong was like all Manyamikas agree that genuine reality is empty of conceptual fabrication. First, I will notice that his definition of what all Madhyamikas agree to is based on, you know, what we, not a Gelugpa definition, but based on a one that would be agreed to by Khorambha and by the, you know, Karmapa that we just read. He says that genuine reality is empty of all conceptual fabrication. But then they go on to assert that genuine reality is not empty of non-dual wisdom. This is what Shendong, or empty of other, really means. That genuine reality is not empty of non-dual wisdom. So that's how he interprets Shendong here. What does it mean that you, like what, have an essential Buddha nature? It means that your fundamental nature is not empty of non-dual wisdom, like you say, not ordinary consciousness, because it's empty of that. But it's your fundamental nature is not empty of pristine, primordial wisdom. He says that's what he got from his teacher. So he's in that same lineage with Kenpo Tsultin Gyatso Rinpoche. And he was, of course, a student of Trungpa Rinpoche, and then after with Trungpa Rinpoche, studied with other Karmakagyupa teachers who were in the lineage from Kenpo Tsultin Gyatso Rinpoche. So they're at least putting this forth as like a position. Now, before we decide like what to conclude about that definitively, I want to just come back to this question of how dang confusing this term Shendong really is. In the early 20th century, a person who's never been heard of before or since just sent a scroll into a monastery in eastern Tibet with a bunch of complicated questions on it about the nature of reality. Such as, at the time of the ground, is our Buddha nature already pure or not? And other questions like, when concepts arise, should we consider them dharmakaya or delusion? And it's like raises all these kinds of questions about, you know, Mahamudra, Dzogchen, point of view, and how are we really supposed to understand it? It seems like you're saying two different things at the same time, right? That's the implication of the question. So the, you know, bright young monk at the monastery is ordered by his teacher to like write a, they consider the questions intelligent, so they write a response. And the response, as far as I can understand, doesn't really answer the question. But what it does do is lay out the different types of Shendong as they were understood in Eastern Tibet in the early 20th century. And so I just wanted to like read you, like, here are seven types of Shendong. I won't read all seven, but just give you a flavor. There's the omniscient Jonang, Dobol Sherub Gyaltsen, who considered consciousness is self-empty, but pristine awareness is other-empty.
Okay. This is self-empty.
Right. Yeshe, pristine awareness here, is Shendong. Serdok Panchen, in the Shakya tradition, considers phenomena to be self-empty, but the luminous nature, the true nature, the dharmata, the real nature of phenomena, to be other-empty. So that would be like a Jonang-related position, right? He's saying it's like, you're saying that the ultimate nature is not empty of itself. Satsang Mati Pancham considers subjects and objects to be self-empty, I guess because they're dualistic when engaging with each other, so they don't have any like graspable nature of their own. But pristine awareness and also space. I don't know if space is meant in some metaphysical sense, like, you know, the space of emptiness, or whether that's actual space. But those things are other empty. And then he gives more examples. One of the other examples goes down. So there's actually seven types. It gets a little confusing. But one of the types seems a little different from the others. And so I mentioned Mikyur Dorje, who, as I was just saying, Mikyur Dorje, the eighth Karmapa, seems to be engaged along with his predecessor and his successor and kind of backing away to a kind of Jonang style Shendong that may have come in with the third Karmapa, Rangjung Dorje. So Mikir Dorje and his followers consider the pure kayas, the Buddha bodies, and pristine awareness to be self-empty in terms of their true nature, but other-empty in terms of the way they appear. So do you see, now that is really interesting, okay? Because now they're saying, oh yeah, we're proponents of self-emptiness and other-emptiness. And we're, if you go with Mikir Dorje, and we're proponents, we believe that even the ultimate reality, the most sublime mind and its object are empty of their own nature, ultimately, right? But in terms of how they appear, what we would say is that they're empty of conventional phenomena. You know what I'm saying? So now you're saying that you're using Shendong, you're saying you're a Shendong, you know, so therefore you're not betraying the earlier, you know, Karmapas who advocated a kind of Zhenong-style Shendong. But your understanding of Shendong has kind of been de-Shendonged in terms of it, because you're not really, like, positing anything as existing in and of itself, including, you know, the Buddha's ultimate mind or the nature of reality. Just saying, yeah, in terms of how stuff appears, what we can say about it is that it's been cleaned up and emptied out of conventional impurity. Right?
Can I just ask you to repeat the conventional bit, all these ultimate reality and wisdom are empty of what?
You're talking about something I said in trying to explain it.
No, just to repeat it. I missed it. You said ultimate reality and wisdom are ultimately empty of self-nature, but conventionally they are empty of...
What he says is, in terms of how they appear, which I was interpreting as at the conventional level, what we say about them is that they're emptied of impure conventional phenomena. Right, that's what I understand. So when he says they're other empty in terms of how they appear, what are they other empty of? Well, what is stuff usually other empty of? You know, it's other empty of all of samsara. So, you know, when you look at a Buddha's body, it's been emptied of samsara. So, well, that's not a problem. It's not even really an ontological statement, you know. Do you know what I'm saying? He's not talking about the nature of how it exists. He's talking, it's like, well, it's pure. But it's like, well, does it exist in and of itself by way of its own nature as pure, or has it been conventionally posited as pure? Well, he's backed away from this idea that these things are pure in and of themselves by way of their own essential nature, while still claiming that he's Shendong. That's my point. You see what I'm saying? Isn't this...
I thought that was what the lineage Shendong is, that they thought there was something that's ultimately existent, but not all Shendong.
That's exactly my point. You're so far ahead of me. No, that's exactly what I'm trying to say. That's exactly what I'm saying to say. That, like, you mean Jonah, there isn't the whole construct of Shendong and all the arguments and discussions about it go back to Dolbo Sherup Gyeltsen. Okay? And he, it wasn't only him, it was other people in, who were influenced by him, who adopted a, like, Shakya Chokden, Rongjung Dorje. These are like Sakyas and Gagyus who appear to have early on held a kind of Jonang-like understanding of Shendong. But it doesn't mean that everybody later on necessarily... Now, some people later on seem to have kind of still maybe have a Jonang-like understanding of Shendong, or at least to teach it. But then you don't know. You know what I'm saying? But then other people say, they don't want to say that they don't, that they discredit Shendong because it's now become part of their lineage. But they could have an understanding of it which empties it out of all of the kind of Jonang-like ideas. Right? That's what I was saying. So that's why when I would say de-Shendong, the Shendong, I didn't mean. It's still Shendong, but it's just now Shendong, what Shendong means. You have the original meaning of Shendong comes from Dolbo. And then it begins to get fractured into all these different understandings, some of which come to be okay. And that's why you have His Holiness saying there's good Shendong and a bad Shendong. Well, actually, there's a whole bunch of Shendongs. But what he's interested in is like the one where you say there's something that exists in and of itself by way of its own nature that is found under ultimate analysis, or one where you take it to mean anything else but that. Right? That could be like a whole bunch of other things. That's what I'm saying. Right. Okay. So I thought that was sort of... okay, so if we keep that in mind, and then Let's see. What did I want to look at next is here it is. Okay. So this is something from another contemporary Karmakagyu writer named Bornholtz. And he has written he's called the definitive book explaining everything you want to know about Madhyamaka in the Kagyu tradition, called The Center of the Sunlit Sky, including a translation of Paul Rinpoche's commentary on Shanti Deva's. But that's like only a small part of the book. It's a very thick book. And so I'm not going to read this whole book to you. But I was just tell you something that it says. He says that Shandong has become the straw man in many arguments about Madhyamaka in Tibet. It's long been asserted by many sectarian-minded people that the Kagyupa are Shandong Madhyamakas, in contrast to the Rongdong position of Tsongkhapa. But in my view, which he bases on Mikir Dorje, the term Shandong was used in specific contexts merely as a skillful means and a hypothetical possibility, or a kind of conventional parlance to use in refutations of other positions. Shandong, as understood by Dolpapa, has no foundation in India or Tibet, as understood by Dolpapa. Mikir Dorje, the eighth Karmapa, says that true Madhyamaka would never reify petty and misleading distinctions such as this. It is more efficacious to refer to the different schools from India with their different perspectives. There's Madhyamaka, which he calls the lineage of profound view, and the Yogacara lineage. So then what Bornholtz does, and he's basically do this on Mikir Dorje, is he can say, well, basically, you know, what we call Shandong in Kagyupa is the Tathagata Garba aspect of the Yogacara tradition. It's not Madhyamaka. So he has a whole chapter that's like, whole section of this book saying, please don't kick me out of the Kagyupa lineage, but I'm going to tell you there is no such thing as Shandong Madhyamaka. When you're talking Shandong, you're talking about a teaching that is not that of Dolpapa, but we can use as a way to talk about what the Tathagata Garba teaching, the Uttara Tantra teaching, comes from India, and it's in terms of the tenet system, it's a Buddhist tenet and it's part of Yogacara. That's what he says.
Another word for Chittamantra.
Yeah, Chittamantra. Sorry, same thing.
Does he say why it's considered higher than the lineage than the Madhyamaka?
He doesn't say it's higher. That's what I was saying. Okay, I was pointing out how another contemporary American Karmakagyu, who has a lot of the same overlapping teachers, sets up his book to make it at least appear and read, you know, in the ladder of tenet systems that you come to this view. You know, he's explaining what he calls Shandong Madhyamaka. There's a whole chapter on it, and it basically is saying that you have to take the third turning of the wheel as definitive, and that means that things do have their own essential nature. Right, and he puts that above Madhyamaka. Bornholtz is disagreeing with that, and he has a different interpretation of how to see. He says basically there's these two valuable traditions of Mahayana, the Sangha yogic practice, you know, practice lineage, and the Madhyamaka wisdom lineage. You know, you've got the love side and the wisdom side, and they have these great heritages that come from the pandits in India, and we have to practice both of them seriously and not be playing them off against each other, right? That's the point of view he takes. And and of course, you know, it is an idea that a Sangha was a Madhyamaka, right? And that he was teaching these texts, and was the text associated with a Sangha, you know, some coming from Maitreya, are not considered even in Gelugpa to be that means that that's a Sangha's final view, is a Yogacara view. So he plays off that idea that, you know, people could put forth you're all essentially Buddhas point of view in order to be helpful to people without that necessarily being their final view. Well, once he says that, you're like, well, if that's what he, you know, if that's what he's going to pull into play, maybe that's what's going on now. You see what I'm saying with the current Shendong and Karma Kagyu? And basically, that's what he wants, whether that's really what it is for everybody, that's what he sees it as being or wants to see it as being. So how then does Shendong, if the real understanding of Shendong that Karma Kagyu should be committed to has nothing to do with things existing in and of themselves, whether they're ultimate or not, then how does, like, why does Shendong, which comes from this guy who uniquely made this claim, get to be like the word that everybody uses? Okay, this is that's a really interesting question. He says, well, basically, it's because the fifth Dalai Lama was, you know, closing down Kagyupa monasteries and locked up, you know, shut down the Jonan monastery and burned the Jonan books and burned books that were took a Shendong point of view that weren't even Jonan, and locked up the Jonan monastery's library so that nobody could get in there and get any of the books or print anymore, and that everybody was like really irked by this, and so the people in eastern Tibet all took this, he says, as like a brand name or kind of like a, what is this? It's like a corporate identity. It's like a, what do we they have these like little slogans, you know, a motto, like Buddha's motto is dependent arising. Yeah, tagline. Yeah, Buddha's tagline is dependent arising, right? And so the tagline of the people of eastern Tibet who felt beat down by the Gelugpas in central Tibet, whether they were Kagyupa or Nyingma or Sakya, was Shendong, you know, because that's what the Gelugpas are trying to, like, stamp out. So that's what we must be. That, anyway, that's his idea. I have a different idea, which I'm not saying his is wrong because it's very cool, but I think it has to do with the fact that some of these early Karma Kagyupas were essentially holding a view like that of Dolpa, like Rangjung Dorje. That's what I think. And that it, then because it's a Karmapa, it's not like, okay, there was some guy over here that was like, I mean, because in Sakya they had Shakya Chokden, but they just said, okay, well, you know, he will just use his books for other stuff. He's not like the Tulku of Sakya. Do you know what I'm saying? It wasn't like Sakya Pandita. You know, it was like, okay, there's a Sakya philosopher, and he changed his mind three times about what he believed, and one of the times he said this thing, and we don't agree with it. So that's not a problem. But if you have like the third Karmapa, and he's like. Advocating this view, you can't like just write it out of the tradition. So, and you see how important the lineage tradition is for these, so they're gonna not write Shendong off, they're gonna rewrite what it means. That's my interpretation.
I mean, in a way,
a lot of people think that. Well, we just said yesterday, it's like I find Tsongkhapa's system very persuasive. And then there's a different level of question about, like, well, how persuasive is it that this is the right reading of Chandrakirti? That's like a totally different question. Whether it's a really good system and a plausible way of reading Chandrakirti is different from, like, am I convinced that this is what Chandrakirti was really thinking when he wrote. You know what I'm saying? It's like you can't. It's like when you read what other people say Chandrakirti is reading, often it's, depending on the section, it can be as persuasive or sometimes more persuasive about certain sections than what Tsongkhapa's system is. Okay, so now, having set that up, I'll say, come back to Carr again and say, what does he then, having, you know, said the basic thing you need to teach people as the highest teaching is that you're essentially Buddhas, and that this, you know, Buddha within, you know, can't be said not to have any existence by way of its own nature. Then he comes to the end of the last chapter, and he said, he kind of semi takes it back. The final, and this fits with my point. He said the final intention of Madhyamaka It's often said that the middle way teachings of Nagarjuna are the most important in terms of training the view, and the teachings of Maitreya are the most important at the time of meditating on the nature of the mind. Both are necessary. You should definitely understand that the final two views of these two traditions do not differ. It's wonderful to be passionate about different aspects of the teachings. And as I was writing this book, my enthusiasm went back and forth as I wrote each section. Passion and enthusiasm, though, can slide into bias and sectarianism and only reinforce ego and cut us off from sources of realization. So what we really need to focus on is seeing how these traditions complement each other as a remedy for bias. And then he quotes the seventh Karmapa as saying, the systems of a Sangha, which focuses on the nature of the mind, the system of Nagarjuna focuses on the emptiness of all things, and then, quote, both systems do not differ in teaching the final true reality. And since this is the very nature of luminous mind, since this very nature of luminous mind primordially is emptiness, and since this emptiness primordially abides as the essential character of luminosity, they have the same meaning. Okay. So that, the seventh Karmapa, I don't know if you caught that, but I briefly mentioned earlier, the seventh Karmapa, the eighth Karmapa, and the ninth Karmapa are all involved in this project of backing away from a kind of reifying sort of Shendong. And even though earlier on he's like presented the Shendong apparently as higher than the other Madhyamaka, at the end he takes exactly this kind of point of view of kind of, okay, now pulling back from the idea that, and that this is higher, and saying, setting them next to each other and has two things that are supporting each other. Anyway. So you can see what I've been doing down there. Okay. It's not very, it's a little bit complicated. Yeah.
It seems from what you're saying, the Madhyamaka perspective of no position, no position kind of thing, it just seems like what, you know, you just simply have to look at how they talk about it and teach practice.
Yeah.
You were saying, it's true, the Gelugs, you know, were all about writing it down and making it clear, and then we study and we learn to practice just like that. But they seem to be, you know, they're more of the Maitreya side, and just approaching it differently. And I don't know, it just seems almost, you know, and I don't know if criticism was coming across or not, like they just won't state the view. But without knowing that other whole huge piece of those ways of being Buddhists, you couldn't really totally compare them. You're just comparing almost apples and oranges.
Well, of course, they're in dialogue with each other for a long time. So it's not just me coming in, setting them against each other. Tsongkhapa was criticizing people who had Sakya and Kagyu-like interpretations of Chandrakirti, and then they, feeling themselves criticized later, then criticized him. So, I think you can be very, I mean, there's other fundamental points, you know, but in terms of this particular issue, they're trying to each say what they think Chandrakirti said and what the Madhyamaka view is, and one is taking it from the point of view of that you don't really know the ultimate unless you have this utterly non-conceptual, non-dualistic, discursive mind. And anything else is just mucking around in the world of falsity. And hopefully you're mucking in a better direction. But then that's always a problem from some, you know, how can you be doing that if everything's thoroughly mucked up, right? Do you see what I'm saying? And then on Tsongkhapa's side, you know, he's going to say, well, that's not right, you know, that we can have these mucked up consciousnesses that mistaken consciousnesses can still give us like accurate information about the world, and we can use, in a particular case, reasoning to understand the nature of reality. And then, you know, we don't want to refute that, but we let's see, what would he say? So, like, We get rid of our attachment to a conception of emptiness by realizing emptiness non-dualistically, not by sitting here and trying to let go of it. Do you know what I'm saying? So they do have a disagreement about whether the final Madhyamaka view is something that when you state it in conventional language, it should be stated as we hold no position because the ultimate is beyond all conceptualization, or whether it should be stated as emptiness is the lack of intrinsic nature in things. They disagree about exactly that. It's not that they disagree about whether things lack intrinsic nature, but they disagree about whether just holding that view represents the Madhyamaka view, even conventionally. Because, you know, Sakya Kauramba and Wangjit Dorje are going to say, no, that doesn't even conventionally express what... It doesn't even convey to people, roughly, this idea that the ultimate is like transcends all dualistic elaborations. So it relates to that thing that we've been, you know, talking about as like different levels or perspectives of the, you know, what point of view do you come at it from? And it's clear that in the talking about what's ultimate, and therefore and what is the Madhyamaka view, is talking about what's ultimate. They're looking at it from the point of an arya. And Tsongkhapa isn't looking at it from the point of view of us. Yeah. So that there is a big difference in what it leads to, maybe. I mean, Tsongkhapa, it's not that other people don't study, and it's not that Gelugpas don't meditate, but there's this big tradition that, you know, Tsongkhapa is like thinking that you shouldn't think of studying as something apart from practice. That when you meditate, you're meditating on just that which you have understood as a result of reading and listening to the teacher. And it's not, he makes it, he's kind of almost like mocks the idea that, okay, yeah, study is something over here, but then when it comes to practice, we'll get some secret instructions whispered in our... He talks about it, like some secret instructions will be whispered, and we'll set to the side everything that we've been hearing before in the lectures and the shastras and the sutras. Forget about that. That's just for scholars. It's so complicated. You know, but the Lama will whisper something in our ear about, you know, how to take a certain Dzogchen posture, and suddenly, you know, basic mind to reality and all will open up. And he's like, he's sort of, not, you know, well, there's a big difference between how His Holiness is about these things, how he chooses to talk, and how Tsongkhapa talks. Tsongkhapa's in the business of making distinctions sharp and clear. He doesn't call people names, but he wants to call people out in terms of, you know, what their positions are and say why he thinks they're wrong. And he calls out a lot of people, and so they, you know, and then lays out a clear alternative. So they take notice, and they take umbrage as well. You know what I'm saying? I'm just trying to say it's not me that's setting up
this.
In fact, I go back and forth. I mean, I can, as I do this, I come from a certain place, as you understand. But as I put to try to explain it, I have to put my mind into that way of seeing it, so I can provisionally see it from their point of view, even though that isn't my final perspective, which is beyond all expression. Just like eating a kumquat, you can't really ever fully, you know. Everything is beyond expressibility in some sense. Anyway, so how do, let's see, where are we? 10, 11:30. I'm supposed to stop at 11:30? Is that right? Or 11:45? Okay, so we should say something about Mahamudra. Some of you have, like, obviously know a lot more about this than I do, but so the way that the view is practiced in Kagyu-sa, of course, is famously known as Mahamudra, and all Kagyu schools emphasize Mahamudra Gyatchenbo, which means the great seal, and is understood as being like the, you know, sublime essence of Buddhist teachings, which comes through a direct personal realization of the truth. And one contemporary Kagyu Lama says, Mahamudra is the Buddha nature. It is the basic mind within all living beings. To know it is to know the true nature of all phenomena. To actualize it is to become a Buddha and to become one with the Buddha qualities. But it's not anything, it's not considered to be non-empty. It's like like we were just describing, the emptiness of the fundamental mind and the fundamental mind having the nature of emptiness, indivisible. So another person says, why is it called Great Seal? Just as a royal seal, it's called, Mahamudra means Great Seal. Just as a royal seal wields unchallengeable authority when it's stamped on something, so the all-encompassing emptiness of ultimate reality prevails upon and is impressed upon every phenomenon in the universe. Okay, so, Mahamudra, the practice of Mahamudra has many things in common with the practice of Dzogchen in Nyingma. It involves a practice in which one is seeking to directly know the luminous nature of one's mind. So to know the fundamental nature of one's mind is to see the mind as luminous, knowing, clear, and empty. To see the nature of the mind sort of includes understanding it in terms of its how it appears and how it ultimately is. Right, together. And then to see, this is basically how to understand the practice, the goal is to try to then see everything that arises in your experience as a manifestation or a wave on this, like if this is the fundamental nature, then everything, all your experiences as they arise are fluctuations or ripples or expressions of or manifestations of that fundamental reality, which was always already there. Okay, then in terms of like how you actually do this, I guess you really a big part of the point is that you have to find an awakened teacher. His Holiness, when we were at Lehi, said, "Well, the most important thing is in a teacher is you have to find a teacher who embodies the qualities that you're seeking to generate by following that teacher." So, if you're seeking to become enlightened, then you would need to have an enlightened teacher. And so you know this is like comes to have a little bit of a quality that reminds you of the kind of mind-to-mind transmission thing in Chan. The fact that there are Mahamudra teachers, it means that they had to have teachers who had this experience, not just an understanding. And their teachers did in turn and so forth back to Vajradhara, presumably. Right? That's the idea. Right? So that's the critical thing. And I think it's sort of course, in all kinds of Buddhism and especially in all kinds of esoteric practice, there's a huge emphasis on faith in the teacher. But I think that even within that, there may be even more here, because there's nothing, it's not really going to help you to study so much. It's all about the kind of instruction and guidance you get from the teacher and how to direct your mind. So there's a huge amount of emphasis on finding the right teacher and then putting faith in a teacher who can skillfully guide your mind. Of course, you also have to have some other little things like true renunciation and wishing to transcend cyclic existence, highly developed bodhicitta and compassion, and so forth. So it's like, oh, well, this isn't so instantaneous as I thought. It's like, so, this is the maybe, I don't know. Try not to say anything negative, but it's like I think that, okay, I won't say a negative thing. Say it's like, oh, this is a skillful way, right, of drawing people into a practice, right, of saying that through this means you can see who tell when you go to America, tell people that they're Buddhas. You know what I'm saying? It's like, well, that's from the Uttara Tantra Shastra. It's like not as though he's just making something up out of nothing. Right, it's a way of drawing people into a practice, which then as they set out to do it, it does actually have a few more steps than just sitting down and seeing it immediately. But So anyway, the important idea is like, so when if you practice this and you recognize that mind and the empty nature of the mind, then when like anger comes up or something like this, then you try to recognize that each emotion, each feeling, each inclination as it's arising as a kind of expression or manifestation or fluctuation of this basic mind, and then let it subside back into that without like becoming invested in or attached to it or being driven by it or something like that, as though it had its own nature, right? So here's a little, poem from an early Kagyupa about there's some different stages that are enumerated in Mahamudra, and one of the more advanced stages is called One Taste. By meditating on this one flavor of all things, the meditator will realize, cognize, or know this single flavor of all things, that everything, the diversity of all appearances and everything that doesn't appear, mind and emptiness, emptiness and non-emptiness, everything is of a single flavor and indifferentiable in its basic emptiness. Understanding and lack of understanding have the same taste. Equipoise and post-equipoise, being in non-dualistic meditation on emptiness and not being in non-dualistic meditation on emptiness have the same taste. Why? Because they're equally fundamentally empty. Meditation and not meditation are of a single flavor. Making discriminations and not making discriminations are of a single flavor in the expanse of reality. So if you actually have then this is sort of like, well, if you're at that level, that's a high level. And I'm going to tell you what level I think it is in a Gelupa way in a second. Because if you're at that level, then it doesn't matter whether you're meditating or not, because everything looks the same.
Yeah.
If you fully realize that level of one taste. And so I don't know exactly what they say in Kagyupa, what they equate that to on the stage of the path, but I would say for Gelupa that means you're a Buddha. Because if non-dualistic realization of emptiness, and then you come out of meditation on emptiness, and everything is just the same as it was before, how can that not be like somebody who's eliminated the obstructions to omniscience? If you take it literally, that it's just the same, whether everything is the same, whether you're meditating on, then by meditating they mean, you know, realizing it. So anyway, this gives you a flavor of what they're, and so then, of course, the tradition goes back to Milarepa. And so we'll end what I have to say about Kagyupa with a song from Milarepa. Looking nakedly and resting still, I, the yogi, Milarepa, look nakedly and see the essence. And what I see is beyond any concept. What I see resembles space. Free from motion, resting still, I realize the true nature of all things, everything is empty, and their empty essence is what I realize. Relaxing loosely, letting go, original wisdom holds its ground in the river of awareness. The mud settles down, the brightness shines. I take my concepts and throw them away. Recollection and thought are cut off. The deep abyss of the six realms has been sealed completely. That's all over for me now. I know for sure my mind is Buddha, so there is nothing I need to gain or to achieve. When realization shines from inside, it's like when the sun's light shines on the night. All my thoughts, the whole collection, and all disturbing states of mind, without effort, in their own place, disappearing now and gone. That's very pretty, isn't it? So inspiring. Yeah.
So, in the talking about things like Mahamudra and stuff, it seems to me that there's still a basic premise that of doing those types of things, that one is engaged in some sort of study as well. So it, like, it would be the same type of thing if somebody came to a Bhukkha thing where go to this concept initiation and that's your introduction, and you can, without kind of the study and understanding the sutra part of it. So it just seems like in some ways it's just a different way. You know, there are people who offer that freely where somebody might have the basis, but the only reason that one's going to attain realization is if they have
developed the basis.
Or if they have the karma, you know, which generally would mean for us that we've studied and they have some understanding.
But yeah, somebody could have it from a past lifetime, you're saying. Yeah.
But so in essence it seems like there's still the premise that if you were to go to a sound teacher in those other lineages, they're not saying just do this sitting practice and follow me. And there may be, because there's people in the Bhukkha where just can sit by my side and do that, and everything's fine in there.
Yeah.
You know, they've got a different karma, you know, a different predisposition. So I don't see in some ways the real teachers in those other lineages would be saying, just do this, you know, esoteric practice, and that's the way.
Well, you have to prepare people's minds. Like, right. If people are like distracted, like when they try to count their breath to 10, then how are they going to be able to do this? You know, and it's like, I mean, I'm serious. That's like, you have to teach people not just like the Four Noble Truths and the Three Jewels and basically some, then you also, and renunciation, but you also have to teach them how to calm their minds down, right? And so there's a lot of groundwork that has to be laid before you can do something like that.
But I guess my question is, let's say, use a word, the practice lineage.
Uh-huh.
It seems like there's still an element of study that's involved in that, and even though that's kind of a label, or you know, the group is more this study piece, it still seems like there's this,
you have to have a
similarity
balance
in terms of what it really takes to achieve some sort of realization. And it doesn't seem that diverse. It seems more
similar
divergent to me than it does diverse, even though you can split the hairs. But my sense is that those teachers who are, you know, what I would consider qualified teachers, have a similar approach, that they wouldn't be, you know, recognized, unless they recognize that somebody had, you know, something from previous life. But we don't, that's not the norm. That's not what my mind.
Yeah. No, I agree with you, actually. And I think that is very much in line with the approaches holiness takes. And it's also in line with what you hear, what I, like, for example, you know, read in, Andy Carr and Carl Brunholz. Like, Carl Brunholz, you know, writes this book, this thick on Kagyu Madhyamaka. And it has a huge section about everything that Tsongkhapa was wrong about. But he also makes the point that, look, you know, we're here in America now, it's not Tibet, and we don't necessarily have to be angry at the people who took over that our part of the country in the 13th century. You know what I'm saying? All these people were fighting with each other, not just like all meditating and practicing. They were all had clan allies and patrons and political alliances with, you know, the Altan Khan in the case of, you know, or this time, and the Sakyas were kings of, basically rulers of Tibet for 100 years, and then so everybody had a turn to, like, this. It wasn't just the Gelugpas, that they're become the bad guys in the last few centuries, you know, from the point of view of the other orders, but the Sakyas and the Kagyupas had wars against each other, you know, before, you know, the Gelugpas had that much political power. So they have a lot of leftover stuff. You know what I'm saying? And it's like, well, why do we have to, like, have that as our stuff? Yes. Yeah. Tibetans are a rough and ready crowd. You should read Genlo Sangyatso's memoirs, where he talks about what it was like in the first part of the 20th century, living in a monastery in Lhasa, and you know, it's like, yeah, there was quite a lot of beating going on. In the monastery. And then that's just the monks with each other. As you get outside the monastery, it's like, well, I mean, yeah. People tried to exercise to fight for what they thought was right. And they didn't, you know, it wasn't like, well, I guess what you could say about Tibet is like, institutionally, they didn't all get organized and make that the purpose of their country, to get organized and conquer other countries or something like that, like the Romans or the Mongols or, you know. There was this huge focus that it's hard to compare to other places on the Dharma. But then it wasn't like there was like some, everything was organized and peaceful. Tibet was a big place and there wasn't any like, you know, rapid communication or transportation. And so there was all these different, you know, territories and local nobles who had control of the land and the resources and who was allowed to pass through this area and that. And then they would have certain, you know, lamas that they were devoted to and the lamas depended on them. What, you know, this is, why does Tibet have a tulku system and you don't have it in other places in the Buddhist world? Well, you know, one way of thinking about this, and I don't, you know, obviously other people could think about it in another way, right? But one non-traditional way of thinking about it is like, well, if our monastery is not going to be able to continue to exist unless we have Lama X, who is the spiritual teacher of noble over here who controls the whole country, then we're screwed. And so we better find Lama X. Be darn quick. Right? Yeah.
I have a question that's sort of related to that and also to something I asked you yesterday. It seems like in the Kagyu and Nyingma monasteries, the meditation practice is like more institutionalized. Or like, I mean, I know one young American who went to study in a Karma Kagyu monastery because he looked at different ones and saw that they practice meditation more. And like the teacher there, I think, even like leads meditation retreats and things to the monks and who's teaching them that in addition to the, you know, the Kempo studies and things. And when then that's not so present from what I've seen in the Lukum monasteries. I wonder why you think that is.
Well, there's been, I mean, it's related to what we were talking about. I mean, this is like each tradition has its distinctive kind of flavor and character. And the Gelugpas are, what do you say, stereotypically, but then it's one of those things that's not without basis, oriented towards book learning and scholarship and study. It's not that these people aren't Buddhist practitioners, but they don't go on like routinely say, okay, now it's time for my 3-year retreat or something like that. It's like, well, there's another book that I haven't studied that's really important. Well, and it seemed really important because my teacher thought I should have been studying that as well. Tends to be, you know, it's that people do meditation practice, but in terms of like deep, extended, institutionalized, routinized practice, it's like not really like so much the focus as it is in these other traditions, because the idea is that if you don't really understand the view, what are you going to meditate on? And if you can't even like understand if you can't even put the words in the right order to express what emptiness is, then obviously you don't understand it, and then you won't, when you meditate, you won't really be meditating on emptiness. You'll be meditating on some, you know, something else, like no positionness or nothingness or neither this nor thatness, you know, and Tsongkhapa doesn't think that that's going to be helpful, right, in terms of getting people free from cyclic existence. So the idea is like, well, you have to be able to understand, if you can't meditate on emptiness unless you understand emptiness, and you can't understand emptiness that easily. So people study a lot of stuff and they try to understand it and then go and meditate on it. I don't think it's that they never meditate at all before that, but that's the idea, is that, and so people, you know, there are Gelugpa teachers who go on retreat and do serious practice, and it's just that, as you put it, institutionally, it's not foregrounded because the emphasis on effective meditation on the view that leads out of cyclical existence has to be based on correct understanding. And that has to be based on what we say study or hearing the Dharma and really getting it sorted out. So it's like first things first. That would be the Gelugpa point of view. Okay. So
I also think that the 3-year retreat, as we all hear our friends doing it, this is a re in Kagyu and Nyingma, this is is a very recent development, just from the latter 19th century. It's not that those traditions have always
been doing that.
This system of the three-year treatment you do at the beginning.
Yeah.
Don't they do the mantras for that retreat?
They have different ways of doing the three-year retreat. Some of them do the mantras in it. Some do something else. But it's a comparatively new.
Do you know why it started then, comparatively new?
I don't know. I think it
would
have to do with
Zhangyang Kongzhou. Lo Zhichai started that?
I'm not sure.
Oh, really?
I don't know.
Yeah.
You made a comment when you were making some distinctions in terms of that Tsongkhapa was very definitive and stated things, and you didn't kind of finish a sentence when you said that his holiness.
Yeah, well, so
a more moderate view. I don't know what, but you didn't finish.
But that's supposedly the topic for tomorrow, and I don't want to run out of things to say. I haven't really, of course, I haven't really at this point figured out what I'm saying tomorrow. But I say that is the topic. So I'm not to do that. Yes.
Oh, what did you say for establishing mindfulness?
Oh.
Establishment of mindfulness on the mind.
Yeah.
Sounds kind of a lot like what you said at Mahamudra, which is supposedly, isn't it a highest class tantra?
Well,
I should say that I was teaching it as His Holiness teaches.
Oh.
I don't know if that is how it's commonly taught in the text.
Yeah.
How
His
Holiness teaches it.
Yes, of course. He's going to bringing in Dzogchen Mahamudra understanding.
Yeah.
Well, see, I mean, I'm aware of the text and the teaching, and I mean, I was thinking of it as something more along the, a sort of a Vipassana mindfulness practice, right? And not something where you're trying to identify the fundamental nature of the mind. But rather noticing, you're just noticing what's happening in my mind moment by moment and seeing what the character of the mind is as it goes along. But it's not like, okay, there's a fundamental luminosity and emptiness of the mind. I don't know, even does it talk, I mean, there's this thing about like watching to see the color and the shape of the mind and seeing how the mind arises and abides and disappears. I mean, I don't know that kind of language is in the Pali text, at least. That's what I've read, is the translation of the Pali text. And it's much more, it's just a regular Vipassana kind of text. It doesn't suggest any kind of, well, it's not like the Uttara Tantra Shastra. They're not, you know what I'm saying? It doesn't come after that, in the wake of that, you know? So there's not this sense that, okay, we're going to recognize a fundamental Buddha mind that's inside my mind, but if I look closely. There's nothing like that about it. And maybe, I don't know how His Holiness does it, but it doesn't feel like that in the Pali.
Yeah, it's not in the Pali, at least not explicitly. If you read into things, you can draw it out.
Right.
But the way His Holiness teaches it is very much a Mahamudra kind of way.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that makes sense. Okay, well, unless you want to start doing Nyingma, then I think we can wait till afternoon. I do have a lot of stuff I want to do with Nipam, especially in the afternoon. So if you have the Sword of Wisdom stuff that I gave you, then be sure to bring that along at 2 o'clock. Okay. Thank you. Through the 16th Gelwa Karmapa.